listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-GM,
McGill, but I'm not a GM this time.
Yeah, I don't know what you are this time.
You do know what I am this time. You've read over this.
I should know what you are, but I can't remember what you are this time.
This time I'm the guide.
The guide who takes us through the gates.
That's right.
It is the 29th of August, 2023. We are recording episode, what episode is it? 161? I think it's 161 at this point. And, 161. And, on this episode, we are going to be, or rather, McGill is going to be talking about a game that someone that I met created and put up online. You can get it just straight up on your browser. It's the gates, the-gates.weebly.com. And so McGill's going to be covering that. Meanwhile, I'm still telling this tale of Coyote's Aegis. We're at a point where the heroes of our story are venturing into the forest of Agaloc to gather up whatever allies they can find that might join them in an attack on the slave outpost of Ashgrain Outpost, the slave-driven industrial breadbasket of the horrible human supremacist society of Agaloc.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Just whatever. So I don't know what we want to start with. You got anything special to cover, or is it just the gates?
It's really just the gates, you know. I was trying to think, before we started recording, if there were any other fun RPG topics or things that I came across. I guess there's one thing that I can mention that I sent to you, which is this special NPC generator sheet. Did you have a chance to take a look at this?
I saw it.
The buff you up NPC generator.
I like some of the features. I like that you could sort of like customize it a bit. But the fact is that like I saw it and I was like, well, I've already got like a dozen NPC generators online to refer to. I don't know. Is there some particular cell for this one that you wanted to hit me with?
I guess the thing, if there's a cool cell to hit you with, it would be that this is all done within a PDF. It's a random generator, but it's contained within a PDF that you can just open with Acrobat and then click the text that says generate, and it fills it up for you. I didn't even know you could do that all within a PDF. I thought you needed like an Excel spreadsheet or something. But here, I'll just give some info to the listeners. I found this on the D&D Behind the Screen subreddit, reddit.com/r/DnDBehindTheScreen, and it's from a user whose username is ggraphart. The topic is, I crafted an intuitive NPC generator that can generate millions of unique, fully customizable NPCs with one click each, and you can download it here. The link is there. They've just got it up on Google Drive. Like I said, the thing that I think is pretty cool about it is that it is a self-contained PDF document that you just open up, you click generate, and it gives you all these details for an NPC. Now, it doesn't roll a full NPC. This is more like generating an NPC, all the like personal details about them, their appearance, their occupation, their alignment, distinctive features and personality traits, their relationships to the characters, their routine, things like that. Each of these fields also has a button to switch, so you can toggle, you know, specific fields and hone the NPC type to, you know, sort of what you want. I do wish, though, that
this
was...
That's the thing that was most interesting to me, was, like, the way that you... Because I always like to see sort of, like, the the math behind the screen going on with the generator and like no like I like to see like if a generator has like an array of names that it can generate, I like to just like see that table of names, truth be told. And so anything that lets me like kind of mess around with the or like customize the results of the generator is always something that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, and this one you can customize any one of these different fields to you know, like you said, switch through different whatever you call it, whatever's filling that field, different options. I like this as like a launch point for NPCs. You know, you might want to get yourself a stat block for whatever system you're running. I think this one is sort of meant for D&D, but because it lacks anything that's sort of systems rules specific, you could probably use it for whatever fantasy setting you want. I just clicked generate and I created Havom, the 57-year-old neutral good dwarf who is below average height, has a frail build, and he's a gravedigger.
He's a dwarf with below average height.
Yeah, he's a short dwarf who's frail and a gravedigger. He's covered in piercings that are adorned with tiny dangling charms, and he tends to perform peculiar rhythmic dances to celebrate victory or successes.
Touchdown dance, I like it.
Yeah, there you go. He develops an intense connection with a passionate and determined paladin, their love a beacon of righteousness. So that's the personal relationship that Havom is sort of destined to have. First impressions are that he's laid back but kind of helpless. I guess that makes sense if he's also frail and tiny. So, like you said, like this isn't something that I think is going to totally wow you, but I do love promoting just cool, open source, fan-made DM resources. And as I said, the thing that I like most about this is that it is a PDF. So like if you say you're one of those DMs that uses a laptop when you're running a game in person, maybe you got a folder there of, you know, your important documents for that adventure, core rule books and tables and things that you found. Well, you can just chuck in this NPC generator along with those. And if you ever need to create an NPC out of nowhere, you know, something that you didn't anticipate, suddenly the players want to strike up a conversation with the local blacksmith. Well, maybe they want Ainforge, the half-orc, who is a tinker and has blue eyes. You know, and also tends to avoid discussing her family or personal history with strangers. So here you go. You've already got like a personality that you can run with on the fly. So that's kind of cool. It also gives you the option to save the generated NPCs. It doesn't automatically clear when you close it. It asks you if you want to save it. So you have the option of creating more of them and banking them away if your players are ever likely to revisit them. So there you go. Cool DM resource. You know, that actually does, this is a sort of a general topic of conversation that I could ask you about, but that does actually bring to mind something that I spotted in the D&D behind the screen subreddit, which is that the mods there have found that since COVID and in the time since like 2020, the subreddit's traffic has started dropping. They get very few posts. Their growth has significantly slowed. And they were just sort of wondering, like, why did it, you know, hey, users, why do you think that is? Why do you think that growth has slowed? Why do you think that people are posting here less? My immediate response was that I don't actually need the subreddit to be totally active because it's such a good archive that you can search for a zillion different ideas as a DM, and you'll really never hit the bottom. There's always something cool there. So it doesn't need to always have new posts like every day to be a very useful resource. But my other thought was, you know, I feel like D&D is more popular than maybe it's ever been. We did just have that D&D movie come out. And we got The Adventure Zone, we've got Critical Role. Maybe there is just like such a preponderance of DM resources and D&D resources online that this one subreddit for DMs, it's not in such hot demand. But I thought maybe I'd ask you, Tom, and maybe not, obviously not about this specific subreddit, since I know you don't frequent it, but are you finding that the D&D popularity is waning, or have we reached like a point of critical mass where there's like there's nowhere left for D&D to go? It's so omnipresent. You know, it's like it's like Fortnite or something. It's one of those games that obviously it's really popular, but in a way it's old hat. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think about this?
I think D&D is fine. I think, well, you know, I think that D&D took a hit with the whole Hasbro controversy.
Right.
I think that it is a combination of D&D being more popular than it's ever been, but also that popularity sort of reaching critical mass and then hitting the point where it's like D&D's the RPG that's made by the man.
Oh.
And if you want to... Now, I think that there are enough people that are, like, into role-playing games through Dungeons & Dragons that now is, like, the best time to be someone who is, like, producing a game that is not Dungeons & Dragons. Because right now, I think it's the stage where, like, a lot of people are looking for alternatives and, like, new frontiers.
Yeah, Blades in the Dark seems to be picking up steam from what I've witnessed.
Yeah, Call of Cthulhu is really big. Pathfinder is really huge right now. I have a friend who's playing Savage Pathfinder, which is Pathfinder with Savage Worlds as its base. Yeah, I think that it is a unique thing where, like, it has always been that the most popular one is Dungeons and Dragons, and then everything else is kind of like a side niche for like people who are really into role-playing games. I think that Dungeons and Dragons, with its increased popularity, has finally reached an audience that a lot more people are getting into role-playing games, and only now are they starting to... Or now I think we're starting to see a large number of people who got into role-playing games through Dungeons & Dragons are starting to say, like, well, what else is out there?
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I do think, I hadn't considered that your point that because of the whole Hasbro debacle, maybe D&D is seen as being like the mainstream RPG, right? The one that's made by the man. Those crappy guys over at the big corporation.
Which, it should be said, it is the mainstream RPG, like, far and away.
Yeah, exactly. It absolutely is. But that does make a lot of sense, because certainly when I think of role-playing games and I think of, you know, the what drew me to, like, D&D when I was really young, part of the fun of it for me has always been that there is this inherent separation from, like, the corporate side of it. Like, you buy the book, the way it's supposed to go anyway in my mind is, you buy the book, you get some paper and some dice, and you can just play the game. You don't need you don't even need to buy the newest edition. Like, it's supposed to be self-contained, and the book is, it's the rule book, but the game itself doesn't even really take place necessarily on a playing field or on the table in front of you. It's in everybody's brains who's playing, mostly. And when you were saying, you know, Hasbro kind of soured their own brand, and the RPG produced by the man, what immediately came to my mind was them talking about that whole, was it One D&D, their big plan for like a subscription model D&D system. And that immediately made me go like, oh yeah, like, I don't want that. That's the antithesis of one of the things I love about an RPG. An RPG is something where you just have the source book. You don't even need to buy the book. You can just download the SRD and then go and play. And you don't have to be constantly, you know, you don't have to pay $10 every month to make sure you have the most up-to-date rules and the most current thing. That's almost more like what Magic the Gathering has really become, where it's all about the current game and they're forgetting about like legacy formats and the old cards. They don't want to think about them. They want you to always be getting the newest stuff. So yeah, I think there is something to that too.
So
speaking of D&D.
Yeah, I guess speaking of D&D, do we want to just jump into my side of things?
Let's do it.
So, the party has been journeying through Agaloc in search of allies for several hours now. They've been fairly successful. In addition to Issa the Myconid, they got a group of Illithids on their side that were grateful they killed a rogue thought from their collective, and they found a group of slaves from Ashgrain Outpost who had recently defeated their Azur taskmasters. They were looking for the location of a river and a waterfall that Issa showed them in their minds, and most recently they had to stop briefly when Gent was overcome by a maddening wailing which echoed sourcelessly through the forest as they traveled. Connor cured Gent with magic, and they're continuing on their way, eventually getting away from the wailing sound. And Gent says, "Yay for Paylor." And I say, Gent did have another ominous vision while overcome by the wailing. They had just voiced the thought that maybe the tentacle flail needs to be destroyed or otherwise disposed of. And Hex says, right. Maybe we should ask those Illithids? I'm not really sure how to destroy it, or what might happen if we did. And Gent says, we could wait until we return to the base, since they have headed there.
Ah, man, bread it and fry it. Make some calamari.
Yeah, I said, to clarify, the Illithids have headed to the front to meet up with the rest of the Draelic army. There's the forward perimeter on the edge of the forest, and then there is the Omega base, which is some ways north of the forest. And they're like, yeah, we mean the front. And Hex says, is it worth leaving now, or do you think we have time to find this waterfall? And Gent says, we can waterfall it up, but any hinky business, and I get to snap it over my hollow Kenku knee. And Hex says, as long as that doesn't open like a portal of doom or anything. Continuing their exploration of the forest, they heard the sound of nasally groaning and moaning ahead of them. As they approached, they saw an old goblin wearing primitive clothes and furs hunched over a small black pond. The goblin's nose appears to have been smashed, and the left half of its face is gnarled to the point where it seems to have the texture of rush-hewn, unfinished stone. The goblin is the source of the noise, and I had them roll insight. We got a 22, a 23, and a 24 for insight, and I said the goblin is clearly distressed about something. It seems the goblin is overcome with grief and was weeping recently. And Gent frowns and says, I will keep back since they passed out last time from the noise. And Connor approaches the goblin and says, peace, friend, what troubles you? And the goblin says, oh, shame of the goblin whose face is riven so. No wonder I am shunned by the sculptors, for beauty of form is their very craft. Woe is me, the goblin whimpers. And Connor says, pardon? And the goblin sniffles, my name is Deg. The sculptors are master artisans, stone giants dedicated to the craft of stone masonry. Their labors were once highly sought after, polished slabs of marvelous size, prized for their youth in the construction of the mantle. They operated a mighty factory where they perfected their art, trading some of the fruits of their labors to the humans in exchange for peace. But recently they were gifted a new material, a dazzling, glittering crystal from the Underdark, which they worked into a statue that is transcendent in its beauty. The goblin practically gasps when remembering the vision he describes. Oh, but I shall never gaze upon it again, never, for I was exiled from the factory, and it is just, for my ugliness should not stain that sacred place. I am not worthy. The goblin bursts into tears.
Aww, and
I
had them roll doesn't look nature, all that ugly.
Arcana and or insight, and we got an 18 for insight, a 17 for arcana and nature, and a 19 for insight. I said, this appears to be a symptom of Grat's madness, manifesting in the form of obsessive vanity. The goblin is despondent, and while his initial accounts of the stone giants sounds fairly typical, it sounds like something has changed them to cause them to develop the same obsession with appearance as the goblin. It's notable that they have apparently gone from more traditional stonemasonry to the art of sculpture so suddenly. And of course, you can't help but wonder if the crystal is the same you collected samples of from Lord Dio's camp. And Connor tries to cast greater restoration on the goblin. The goblin slowly wipes his eyes and says, ah, forgive me. It seems I lost my composure for a time. Thank you. He looks to Connor, waiting for a name. And Connor says, no problem, Deg. You can call me Connor. Where are you from? He says, "Well, I have long avoided the lash of Ashgrain outpost by hiding in the walls and machinery of the sculptor's factory. It was easy enough until the humans brought that crystal." And the goblin's eyes go a little misty at its memory. Connor says, "These sculptors, do they serve Ashgrain outpost willingly?" And Deg thinks for a moment and says, "Initially, it was a matter of self-preservation. They traded their works to the humans in exchange for peace, and that allowed them to keep their factory and do as they pleased. But when the humans brought the crystal, the stone giants became willing to renegotiate. I believe some went with the humans. I must confess, I was distracted, as were the sculptors, truth be told." And Connor says, "Well, Deg, things are about to get a little heated around Ashgrain. The Draelic army is already moving through Agaloc to deal with these human supremacists. I'd advise you get somewhere safe. And if your giant friends are buddy-buddy with the humans, it sounds like your factory is in danger. You'd be welcome to take refuge with our military forces if you'd like." And then Connor turns and says loudly into the bushes, "Sounds like we may be able to free some giants to help us fight these bastards. Are you guys even here?" And Hex slinks out of the bushes. Deg's eyes widen. "Perhaps I can be of some assistance. I know the location of the factory, after all. If you could help to clear the minds of the sculptors there, as you did mine," he trails off. "I would not trespass there again myself, as I still fear the wrath of the sculptors that exiled me. But I could show you the way." And Jed says, "So some giants went with the humans. What happened to the others?" And Deg says, "They remained at the factory. After all, someone had to remain to exile me." And the goblin frowns. And Gent says, "They sound like dicks. Were they like that before the stone?" And Deg shakes his head. "Before the crystal, they paid me little mind. Their focus was on working of their machinery and the perfection of their stonemasonry. When the humans brought the crystal..." Deg has a bit of a reverie. "We were all entranced by its beauty. The giants set to work on it right away. I marveled as they did, and I believe that's when the humans left. I think that there were less stone giants when the humans were gone. I don't know where they went. I was just watching them sculpt the crystal." Deg shudders, snapping himself out of it. "But when they were finished, one of them turned to see me watching and became enraged that one such as I would stand in the presence of such physical perfection. They declared my stunted form and riven face to be a mockery of tree beauty and cast me out so that they could work in the solace of undisturbed perfection." And Gent says, "I think we smashed the crystal." And Hex says, "Yeah, sounds like we have a graven image to demolish."
This sounds, this reminded me a lot of the Dark Crystal, actually.
It's funny, Deg's intro where he says, "Oh, woe of the goblin whose face is riven so." It's all just like a take on the polar bears from Balto. Phil Collins.
Of course. Your favorite movie.
Shame of the polar bear who cannot swim. No wonder we are shunned, etc. So when they say we should smash the crystal, Deg looks shocked at this suggestion. But while he briefly appears to be about to offer protest, he can't seem to muster an argument against them. And Gent says, "We would be happy to have you show us where the factory is." And Deg lets out an audible gulp, but nods. Deg leads them to the factory as promised. Checking their map as they follow, they determine that their course is shifting southward, veering slightly west in the direction of Ashgrain Outpost and the Mantle. Eventually, Deg refuses to go further and directs them towards a giant set of stairs that lead to two large, intricately carved stone doors. And Hex says, "Thanks, Deg. Take care." And he says, "I wish you luck. Hopefully you could bring some peace to the sculptors as you brought me." And Jed says, "Poor guy. Too bad we didn't have another person looking for love. Old squish face goblin love."
Wait a minute. Isn't there an entire dating agency based on this?
Hex says, "Oh, we should have set him up with the nut farmers." And Gent says, "Right? Okay, how do we want to do this? Pretend we are there to look at the crystal or inspect the factory? Just sneak in general?" Hex says, "Might want to be sneaky. I don't know how these guys will respond to anything, what with the madness." They say, "Fair. Can't logic with crazy. Although the Illithid was entranced by the rod, maybe the giants will be as well." Hex says, "That's true. Maybe they'll sense a kindred spirit or something." And Gent says, "Maybe plan B that. Plan A is sneak, cure giants, and smash the crystal. Plan B, use the rod to ingratiate ourselves with the giants, then trick them into being healed and smashing the sculpture." And I say, as far as sneaking goes, you'll definitely know it's possible to sneak into and around the factory, because apparently that's how Deg lived there. Hex says, I'm just worried that we'll need to destroy the statue first, or they'll just get reinfected with madness. Jen says, side note, we need to also be prepared for being affected by this. And Hex says, yeah, it might be brain cap time. So at that point, everybody takes their brain cap plus and then get ready to sneak into the factory. Gent gets a 35 for stealth. Hex and Connor both get 17. And they say, scouting out the perimeter of the factory, you find a massive panel door with a large crack in the wall next to it. The crack would be relatively small to a giant's eye, but the three of you are easily able to slip through it unnoticed, albeit with a bit of time and effort. The sound of metal striking stone can be heard echoing from within. As you climb through the crack, the smell of unwashed beings and refuse wafts over you. Once inside, you hear the sound of stone on metal, sometimes gentle taps, other times violent hammering. Faces adorn every surface, primarily faces of stone giants, which range from serene and welcoming to twisted and hateful. Inside, the factory and its machinery are in a sorry state. In some places, unfinished statues that range from 2 feet to 20 feet tall are broken and strewn about, pieces littering the ground. Refuse is scattered about, and the stone giants you see here look and smell unwashed. There are two giants. The first is an 18-foot-tall male stone giant in dirty robes that hunches over some pieces of stone and crystal near a large stone-cutting machine, working with intense focus. A warm, noxious smell emanates from the giant. It appears that while the giants are sometimes carving new pieces, other times they are modifying the walls and even destroying the machinery to work in more serene faces and dark visages. In the center of this large structure is a 20-foot-tall purple statue that glows with a soft light. Upon closer inspection, you realize that the statue has been carved from a single large piece of crystal and resembles a perfectly rendered stone giant wielding a mighty great club. The statue is a thing of undeniable beauty. Next to the statue, a female stone giant works at a smaller piece of crystal about the size of a human. I had them roll Arcana. Jank gets a 17, Hex gets a 6, and Connor gets a 10. And upon closer inspection, they see the smaller crystal the female giant is working on looks like an elf with near perfectly carved proportions. And Jen asks if it's the same as the purple crystal they saw earlier. And I say it certainly seems like it, though the big statue is made of a huge piece of it, much larger than anything you would have been aware of previously. And Gent asks, do we recognize the elf that is the statue? And I have them roll a perception with advantage, and they get a 23. And I say, you don't recognize the elf, but using their trioptics to zoom in, you see that the face is contorted into a visage of hatred and loathing. And Gent asks, do we see any Gratz images or symbols? And Alex says, yeah, anything come in a six-pack here? I get them to roll religion. Alex says, fuck, my rolls have been so bad. Hex 2, Connor 3. Meanwhile, Jenk gets a 24. I say, there's no obvious direct visual references to Gratz, but the visages that have been carved all over the place, some of them have a sort of demonic vibe, and the sheer number of faces alternating between serene and menacing does recall some of Gratz's portfolio of madness and corruption. So it's not like the giants are openly worshipping Gratz. They probably don't have any concept of that connection. Jen says, yeah, okay, how do we cure the giants? And Alex says, all right, Connor's got plenty of spell slots left for greater restoration, but it's a melee range spell. So do they seem pretty distracted? They do seem pretty distracted at the moment. Let's take positions around here, then have Connor try to sneak up on one of the giants. And Jen says, works for me, except the Connor sneaking. I mean, of course. And I say, Gent's invisibility probably gives them the greatest range of options here. And Hex says, yeah, do you have any explosives or a way to topple the statue? Connor could give you a frag grenade. And Gent says, do we want to destroy these before we cure the madness? Seems like they are helping keeping these guys distracted. Hex says, yeah, for now, but if Connor screws up his approach, we might need to draw their attention elsewhere. And Jed says, oh, I can definitely get on board with that. I say, all right, so what happens first? And so first, Hex creeps along the edge of the room toward the younger male giant, gets a 28 for stealth. Gent sneaks opposite Hex and only gets a 26. Only a 26. And I say, Gent, I assume Gent is heading for the female giant in the center of the factory. And Hex says, well, that's where Connor is going to try to sneak, but he'll go last. And Gent waits for Connor to decide. More important that he has the ideal for the ideal spot for this. And so Gent's sticking to the wall. Connor moves into the center and rolls an 11 for stealth. But the giant does not take her eyes off their work at any point. And everyone's like, oh, wow, nice. And he says, all right, Connor will walk up and try to greater restoration her. And the giant quickly snaps her attention to Connor with a scowl. Yes, what is it? She snaps impatiently. As Connor casts the spell, the intensity fades from her face. She begins to look around the factory, grimacing. What? What? What have we done? She shrieks. She then turns her attention to the huge statue near her. She looks around the factory with horror on her face, but as she lays eyes on the crystal statue again, she seems calm. Gent says, oh shit. Okay, well now we know. And it doesn't seem like the madness is gripping her immediately again, though. It seems to have an unstable grip on her mind at this point. Like she was sane, but it's slowly dragging her back. And Connor tries to push the statue over. He says, how big is the statue exactly? And I say, 25 feet tall. And he says, Connor will activate the ivory elephant. I say, okay. I say, we're going to break here. And Hex says, sweet. And Gent says, ivory versus crystal. It's weird. I say we're gonna break here, but then do we actually break here? Yeah, I think we just broke here with the ivory elephant going up against the crystal. But you know,
what?
I think we got time. I think we got time that we can like keep going.
Oh, thank goodness.
I kinda wanna hear about your end of things though.
Oh, okay. You wanna do like a little stop off at the danger room in between your segments?
Yeah, sure.
Because I want to know what's going to happen. All this setup.
I didn't give you a lot of chance to get a word in edgewise, though, through all of that. What do you think of all this? We got new potential allies in the form of stone giants, but they were cursed with a madness of vanity that made them banish that poor goblin Deg.
Well, like I already said, reminded of the Dark Crystal quite a bit. The idea that, you know, there's this big jewel that they've become obsessed with and they sort of worship it. And it's, you know, how can we even compare to the perfect beauty of the stone? Really liked all that stuff. And I like the setup of this adventure. How to articulate this? There's a particular kind of adventure structure that I feel like this might follow, but I don't know what's going to happen next. But I like an adventure where the players have to sort of go into the middle of, I'm going to say, enemy territory, even though you said, you know, it's quite possible these giants are going to become their allies, but like go into the middle of enemy territory and they have to steal something or destroy something or dismantle something, that as soon as they do that, it's very likely that everything's going to go to hell and they're going to have to, like, you know, get out by the skin of their teeth at the end of it. I guess this structure applies to things like heists, any sort of infiltration mission, but I always like that adventure structure where it's got these two sort of distinct halves, this quiet, slow burn tension of the first half where they're trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to pull it off? And then inevitably when they do, you know, the alarm gets sounded or someone notices or the spell is broken, and then everything goes crazy. Maybe they're going to fight. Maybe they're going to run. Maybe they'll get captured. Who knows what happens next? Yeah, I'm a fan of that kind of style, and that's why I was like, what? You broke there, but I want to know, like, what's going to happen when they destroy the statue? What's going to happen?
You mentioned the start of this adventure. I finally have to say, so the thing is, a lot of the intro to this adventure was not taken from a module. A lot of the in-between stuff was, like, just me making stuff up about, like, introducing all these NPCs that I'd previously introduced, although some of them were new, like Deg is new and things like
that. Deg is great, by the way. Love the voice.
Thank you. The thing is, now we are finally getting into the point where I'm starting to touch on the content that was actually from a module, which was I was using for this adventure DDEX 03-15 Sithmor Cain Unbound. Sithmor Cain Unbound. And this is all about basically the need to liberate the outpost of Sithmor Cain. Yeah, it's funny. I'm seeing all these reviews on on DM's Guild for this. Somebody hit this with a 1-star review.
Oh no!
He says, "Dear Adventurers League authors, please be aware that your Adventurers League dungeon masters have jobs, families, and other interests. We would appreciate it if you would respect us and our time by not constantly asking us to prepare 17 encounters when the players will experience 4 of them. Modules like this are a slap in the face and the reason why so few volunteer to DM. 1 out of 5 stars. I thought it was great. I think it's full of content. It's a great module.
Is this one of those modules with like branching, a lot of branching paths? So you have to sort of prepare encounters, but they might take a right instead of a left and skip the encounter entirely?
It's also such a big module that like it's one that I specifically chose not to run when we did Ashes Against the Grain. So really, this is a case of me, as I'm looking through this module, this is a case of me using the whole meat, because
You used 17 encounters?
Yeah, like, if it's 17, like that guy said. The adventure background is the factions have been helping the Drow of Sithmor Cain since the Fire Giants of Maramidra displaced them. With the Drow pushed away from their homelands, nothing will soon stand between Gratzmad and Fire Giants and Hillsfar itself. In an effort to keep the Fire Giants away from Hillsfar, the factions have decided to enlist adventurers to retake the Drow outpost of Sithmor Cain, giving both the factions and the Drow a base from which to lay siege to Maramidra. To that end, adventurers have also been rallying some denizens of the Underdark to their aid, including the Myconids of Spordome and the Mind Flayers of Rigsgig. If so rallied, these allies will be of use focusing their resources on taking Maramidra back. Focusing their resources on taking Maramidra back has stretched the factions thin. The characters must decide if they can set aside their prejudices and accept aid from the various outsiders. Once the characters recruit local allies and gather information about the current state of Sithmor Cain, scouts must be overtaken and evaded, soldiers must be distracted or defeated, and finally the Forge Priest, Dengor, must submit or at least be deposed. So I was running this is what I ran as Ashgrain Outpost, and there's basically, you have a big old meeting of, like, all the people. There's a bit of a connection here. I had the setup where Commander Gog told them about a dragon that he knew that they could potentially meet up with the forest. That is a special mission side quest here from the Order of the Gauntlet. The Order of the Gauntlet wished to find a long-lost friend. Some time ago, the Drow Archmage, Solemn Nedrezak, captured an ally of the Gauntlet, a bronze dragon by the name of Masanth. Characters that are members of the Order of the Gauntlet faction and rank 2 or higher are contacted and asked to perform a special mission to find and return the bronze dragon Masanth. So you can sort of see how I'm like reskinning some of these little side quests, because, like, you know, Gog told them about a dragon similarly. Like, that's me putting that same thing here. But then the part where they go through the forest just rounding up allies, another thing I did here is what they have is for navigating the Underdark. So they have a random encounter thing where every 4 hours that the characters are near Sith Morcaen, you roll a d20 and consult the following random encounters table to determine what, if anything, they encounter. And I was using the whole meat because I just had them run into every encounter. So they run into escaped slaves, which happened last episode, where they ran into the escaped slaves in the dry creek bed. But then also after that, you have the imperfect Gale Abdur, which is the characters hear the sound of grinding stone ahead of them. As they approach, they see a rock-like being, a Gale Abdur. The right half of the creature has been carved to resemble a beautifully rendered stone giant face, albeit with a shattered nose. The other half is rough-hewn, unfinished stone. And this, of course, is Deg. This was, instead, I had it just be a goblin who'd been living in a stone factory.
Right on.
But in the original version, it's Grek, the Gale Abdur.
It's fair.
And he's sad because he got kicked out by the stone giants.
It's kind of remarkable how easy it is to sort of remix and reskin like that. And like, if I swear, Tom, if you played the same module with me, but shuffled around like the order of events and then just reskinned it to be a different setting, I'd probably never guess, even if I had played the same adventure, you know, 2 weeks prior.
I mean, the thing is that I basically have done this to you.
I'm sure you have, yeah.
or like, you know, when I ran Ashes Against the Grain, it was almost all modules from this season of the Adventurers League. Like, we started with No Foolish Matter, which, like, that one was easier for you to identify.
Yeah.
Like, Foulness Beneath Mole Master is easy for you to identify. But then, like, the one with the mercenary base and the Kuotoa under the cliff and all that, like, I don't think you necessarily recognized that one when I was explaining it to you.
No, I didn't. I mean, you have since clarified it, and now I'm totally gonna be able to recognize it. Do it a third time, Tom, and I'll call you on it, I bet.
We'll see. Unless I do a cyberpunk version.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Whatever group replaces the Kuotoa, it might tip me off. Wait a minute. These guys are all living near some kind of cistern.
They all know this song. Blah, 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 blah. So, McGill, do you have any other questions for my side of things or anything?
No, I just want to know what's going to happen next, man.
Yeah, well.
But first.
We freeze frame with the elephant pushing over the statue.
And then we hop on over to the gates.
The gates.
Which, as you said before, is available for free at the-gates.weebly.com. I read through this whole thing, and you know what? You know how I've been putting off getting into the gates because I've been busy and I didn't feel like I had the time to dedicate to it. I was totally wrong. I could have done this way sooner. I could have done this way sooner.
I didn't want to pressure you like that, you know? Like, I didn't want to be like, come on, McGill.
But I bet you know why I had the impression that it would be a grander undertaking than it was.
Because it's divided into a few different pages.
No, it's because it is in part inspired by Nobilis, and like I still don't fully understand parts of Nobilis.
Right. So I guess this is the big question: is do you understand the gates relative to Nobilis?
Yes, the presentation of the gates is much more just well thought out, well laid out. I think that the website presentation even works really well in its favor because, you know, the landing page, you get the basic setup of the game, and you also sort of get little key bits of terminology, and then from that main landing page, you get links off to different facets of the game, quest, power, And then on top of all that, there's a glossary of terms too that's easily linked to. So just easy to bounce back and forth around the website, referencing different parts of the rules. It's all laid out very clearly. And as I mentioned before, in this case, instead of a GM, it is the guide. Now, I'm going to talk about the gates, but I have a feeling that you might know more than me because you met the author of the gates, and you said you had also... Did you come up with, like, a character for the gates?
I had messed around with some ideas and stuff. It's been a little while now. But it's definitely something I had mentioned on the podcast before, is, like, the idea of... You're choosing your upper soul and your under soul. And I had ideas for that, certainly. But, like, I don't know that I have a character created.
I don't know if we'll... Maybe we'll get to character creation today and we can come up with a character. But really, I just wanted to sort of pick your brain on the way that this game seems to play out. Because about halfway through... the first page on quests, I started thinking to myself, like, is this an RPG? This almost seems like a ritual you're taking part in. What was the name of the author? I couldn't find.
Lucayo?
Lucayo.
That's how I know them. Lucayo.
Are they very into, say, paganism or? Witchcraft, Wiccanism,
all that witchy stuff, man.
Yeah,
I'm part of the community, and everybody's got witchy stuff going on, and I'm like, I don't know, not me.
Yeah, there's a lot of witchy stuff here. You know what I might even actually say is, listeners, warning: if you live at home and you have very religious parents, they might really start to look at you funny if you play the gates, because, well, seriously, right? Like, D&D and role-playing games in general have a degree of stigma. It seems to have basically faded now, but they were a part of the satanic panic of the 80s. Even in junior high school, I had an art teacher accuse me of worshiping Satan because I had a Rift book in my backpack. True story.
Man, did you even go to a Catholic
school? No, I didn't. I went to public school.
That's insane.
It was wild.
I went to Catholic school.
Yeah. But, like, the gates, while I think this stuff is very cool, I like the description in it, like, not just how you should play, but sort of, like, how you should set up to play.
Yeah, I feel like we're losing our right-wing libertarian fan base over this episode.
Oh, God, do we have one of those? I hope not.
It's always a good joke.
Get lost if you are a part of that fan base. I don't need you, man. Be gone. But like you sit in a circle and you create a sigil in the center, and you have to bring beads, buttons, stones, glass pebbles, wood carvings, or other small handheld materials that must have multiple replicas. Glass beads, chess pieces, metal rings. You need a divination tool of some kind, which can be tarot cards, runes, sacred dice. And I really love that even in the material needs list, they include a large box, chest, or bag to keep everybody's notes and tokens together. I like that, like, there is this sort of ritual aspect to it. I mean, there's a ritual aspect to just about any RPG. We are sitting around a table, you know, we are doing collaborative storytelling, a form of guided storytelling where somebody is concocting a world of fantasy in our minds. But this, more than any RPG I can think of, really sort of hammers home that ritual to it. You will need at least, so to facilitate a quest, you know what, I should actually just sort of read a few parts of this to get the terminology out there to describe the setup, and then we can dive a bit into the rules. So here is the introduction to the gates. Through the gates of the spirit lands, a call is echoing across worlds. This is a call to action. This is a call for healing. For some, it begins in their dreams. For others, it is a bird staring from telephone wires, a reflection in a window, a whisper on strange and fragrant breezes. Within the hearts of the hunted and the minds of the struggling, something within stirs and sparks. You are one of those who can feel the call. A figure constantly beckoning you, or maybe it is a song that asks you to follow, or a code that appears everywhere you go that only you can decipher. Whether in your waking or sleeping life, you hear glimpses, see snatches, unfurl a yearning that finally propels you to seek out what is calling you. That's when you end up at the crossroads. Perhaps it is a crossroads while you dream, a place that has never existed and never will. Perhaps you end up at a crossroads in your neighborhood, asphalt and stop signs, limned by moon's glow. Perhaps you wander into a crossroads far out from any city or town, two hiking trails etched in dirt lying at the base of a sprawling tree that shades you from the sky. Wherever you are, whichever crossroads you come upon, you find me there, the guide. A being...
No, it's McGill.
It's me. A being part spirit or partnered with spirits, waiting for you, calling to you. I may look like someone you know, someone from your own life. Perhaps I am only a person you've ever seen in your dreams or in half-forgotten fragments. I have sent out the call because I search for the ones who have enough spark to journey into the spirit lands so that they can remember who they truly are. Only then will they be able to help liberate the worlds from an ancient torment, an ongoing threat that permeates every life in your world in a myriad of ways. Are you ready to journey into community and begin your quest? Are you ready to find your personal and collective power? Are you ready for the liberation of worlds? Then come with me through the gates. Great intro. And the game itself, before I get into like the material needs and sort of the ritual setup and everything, just based on that introduction, the game itself has a lot of flexibility of the setting that you choose, the types of characters that you play. There's suggestions in the notes that say, like, you know, it can be in space, or it can be in a fantasy world. It can be the setting itself is very freeform, and the system accommodates like whatever setting you want. But that introduction immediately to me suggests things like The Matrix, or The Invisibles, if you want to go in that direction. But this idea of, like, you know, it's almost like the monologue from Morpheus when he first meets Neo, where he says, like, there's always been something that you've noticed, something that makes you different that nobody else has, and you felt it in the back of your mind, like a splinter in your brain driving you mad. It's everywhere around you. That is the sort of the vibe I am instantly getting from all this. Maybe I'm, I don't know. Because
makes me want to touch on, like, I love sort of measuring or like thinking about like the ways that different games sort of phrase like your protagonist situation. Basically, is like there's so many ways that a game can tell you that like you are the chosen one, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking particularly like single player video games. My favorite one has always been in Deus Ex when the AI tells you that the unplanned organism is a question asked by nature and answered by death, but you are a different kind of question with a different kind of answer. That's the coolest fucking thing that's ever been said.
That is pretty, yeah, that's pretty damn cool. Yeah, the lingo here is very easy to understand for me as well. I think this is sort of a key difference with like Nobilis. I found that every bit of terminology felt like something from a foreign language. Like as an example, not to get too ahead of myself, but one aspect of the gates is something called the center, which is a communal space where all the characters, you know, go to. There's a unique object that is the key that leads them to the center. The center reminds me of the chancel in Nobilis, right? Where the chancel is right. Like the home of the nobles that the players are playing as. But it's just so much more easy to understand like the center versus the chancel. And similarly, like the GM player character, because the title of GM sort of is passed around in the gates. Different people can take turns being the GM, but the title being the guide, as opposed to the Hollyhock God. Like, I just find that this language conveys these ideas very instantly, and you don't have to go like the Hollyhock. Like, do I need to know much about Hollyhock to understand what this title entails? So I really do appreciate, you know, my intimidation at hearing that the Gates was inspired by Nobilis was unfounded. I appreciate the clarity and the ease with which I was able to understand all of what is being talked about here. Also, using very simple terms too, like the call to action. Like, let's just go straight for, you know, Joseph Campbell in The Hero's Journey. Like, everybody gets the idea of the call to action. So, yeah, all of these things I really appreciate. It's pretty easy to understand. So,
I also like that, like, the material need of a divination tool is very much like, you see it later is like, it's basically said like, that is like your last resort. That is like the thing. If you truly need like a randomized answer, or like if you truly can't tell where the narrative should be heading, then you turn to the divination tool. But like, it's not presented the same way as like, okay, you're going to need some dice to play this game. It's like, no, you'll want to have something that like generates sort of, you know, some sort of an oracle, basically. But that is something that is like not the heart of the game. It is just something that you may use.
Yeah, for sure. And the one part of the rules where I started to sort of lose the thread and felt like I needed to see a transcript of play was getting into the different types of tokens. This is definitely an RPG where tokens seem to be the key tool at the center of it all, is using tokens, banking tokens, using tokens,
which
as a
resource. Which I think is pretty smart relative to Nobilis, because Nobilis has that whole idea of like spending and accumulating miracle points. But of course, like, wouldn't it be easier to have those represented as tokens if that's the economy of the game?
Yes, exactly. For sure. The connections to Nobilis that I see in the Gates, I feel like across the board, they are just sort of more elegantly handled. The same ideas, but just written out in a way that I don't feel like I'm losing my mind reading it, you know? I can understand it very clearly, even the parts where I'm like, I could use a bit more clarification on how that functions within the game, but I understand what you're saying. So, the primary, like, the mission, the quest, the adventure, the session, it is called a quest in Gates. A quest is multiple visits through the Gates into the Spirit Lands for the purpose of remembering who you really are, finding your power sources, and going into battle. These quests must be done with other questors, for together you have a precious and sacred power beyond the likes of our adversaries, community power that heals and creates new worlds. So we're all going on a quest together, and here are the material needs for the quest. Right off the bat, the first bullet point, I go like, wow, okay. You need a fully accessible space for 4 to 7 living human questers, a space that includes food, water, and toiletries, of course. So this game requires minimum of 4 participants, maximum of 7, and it seems like already I feel like we're getting above the number of people that you, Tom, will gladly run
not
a game
me.
For, right?
Yeah, not me.
Well, I guess it says here one of the participants must always be the guide. So I guess 4 participants, 3 players, and 1 guide, I guess you could run it. But it does seem like it's aiming for a bigger group, like 5-6 people, you know? You need sacred tools, chalk, string, tape, etc., for creating and opening the gates. This is what I'm talking about there being like a witchy, ritualistic aspect to it. You need liquid, herbal, or stone offerings. And then, as I mentioned before, a variety of beads, buttons, stones, glass pebbles, wood carvings, small handheld materials that must have multiple replicas of itself. you know, it's not mentioned here, but a big old bag of RPG dice seems like pretty good way to pretty good thing to use for tokens. Paper and writing utensils for taking notes and making drawings. A divination tool that we've mentioned already, something like runes, sacred dice, tarot cards, and then a large box, chest, or bag to keep everyone's power notes and tokens together. If they would prefer the guide, keep it and take it out for every visit. I just really love the flavor of the inclusion of that. It conjures up this image of everybody coming to play the RPG and then, you know, the guide emerging from behind a beaded curtain with a bejeweled chest that they open up and take out, you know, the sacred ruins, the bottle of cold herbal tea for an offering, you know, the white chalk and string. I like that this game is sort of, it feels like it is guiding you through getting ready to play the game as much as using that to create a mood, I guess, if that makes any sense.
You build a little kit.
Yeah, exactly. You got to build a little kit. You need your game kit. I love a little kit like that. It would be great to get, you know, like a bento box with all the drawers and have all your stuff in there. That'd be fun. For a single quest, one of the participants must always be the guide who takes the participants through the gates over into the spirit lands on a visit, usually of 3 to 5 hours in length, so average session time, 3 to 5 hours. The guide creates and opens the gates in this world for each visit. Depending on the guide, creating the gates can be making a representation of the crossroads, like a photo, a model, a drawing in chalk, so that the questers know that though they sit in this world, they are crossing over to the spirit lands together through the power of their guide, their community power, and the gates. Again, this is what I'm talking about, where this does strike me as an RPG where if somebody stumbled upon people playing it, they'd go, what are these people doing? Are they trying...
What are you drawing those lines with chalk
trying
for?
To do,
making a ritual
exactly,
circle?
Trying to do some magic? The guide chooses a very specific room that they set up protective wards around, blessing and cleansing the space, and calling in spirits and or deities that have dominion or affinity with crossroads and liberation to assist in the quest. Now, Tom, this line, are we talking in-game or out-of-game?
Man, you haven't even got me to the part that I was confused a bit about, which was the offerings.
Yeah, okay. So... A specific room that has been set up with protective wards, blessed and cleansed. Okay, other forms of the gates could just be a giant quartered circle drawn in chalk or made by string, cloth, or tape. The participants all sit within the circumference of the circle, facing the cross at the center that is the symbolic crossroads. When they are sitting in the circle facing each other, they are working on a quest through the gates. When they leave the circle, they go back through the gates into their own world again, where they could be taking a break, going to the bathroom, grabbing a glass of water, ordering food. So I like that. In fact, that sort of, it contains an idea that, you know, who knows when I'm going to be playing D&D in person again, because these days I play pretty much exclusively online, don't live anywhere close to any of my friends these days. But I do kind of like the idea of a rule where it's like, if when you are seated at the table, you are in character and in the game. If you get up from the table, then you can be out of character. You can go get a drink. You can go to the bathroom. But when you're at the table or when you sit in the circle of the gates, you are in the game. I like that. That just sort of as a hard, fast rule. I could see that really cutting down on the kinds of snarky comments that you dislike, Tom. The ones that...
Yeah,
that undercuts,
when I'm a grump.
Yeah, the ones that undercut the mood. Good rule. Okay, so in the first visit called the initiation, there are 5 parts. They are the offerings, the center, the souls, the oprimus or oprimus, and the vow. So the offerings, this is the thing that you said you got you going like, what?
I was like, in real life?
That's what I'm saying. The more that I read of this, the more I go like, but are we doing this for real, real? The guide asks each participant to put an offering into the quest to show their commitment to the quest before the initiation is attempted. Offerings can be in the form of liquid, like water, alcohol, or tea. Sacred herbs, like tobacco, betel nut, or mugwort. I actually have a betel nut box. Man, if I ran a game of Gates, maybe I would use my betel nut box as the chest that keeps all the game materials. Or precious stones, crystals, glass, and shells. After initiation, offerings will be buried by the nearest tree or given into the nearest body of running water.
I just grabbed all my sacred herbs, which is all my weed, but now you're telling me I gotta throw it in a stream?
In the lake.
Not me. Not me. Not me.
So yeah, you know, IRL, are we doing this? Are we doing this for real, or are we doing this, like, is this a game? Is this a game? Tom, is this a game? Or is this something we're doing? Is this a ritual we're conducting? Is this guided meditation? Or a form of therapy, perhaps? What is...
I mean, it could
what
be.
What is the Gates?
We'll get to pretty, in the examples of play, things get pretty wild. You end up, like, helping your friend after they had a bad time at a drag show.
So, I am realizing, you know, maybe this isn't actually a game. The first thing it says on the landing page is, the Gates is a collaborative mystical experience inspired by role-playing games and rooted in ceremony, healing, play, and liberation. I don't know, it almost sounds like therapeutic, right?
I mean, there's definitely, there's a lot, there. Like I say, example of play in the examples that are presented, it is very much about providing an actual sort of community support group together for one another for like real problems that you're dealing with in your life. But those are all represented by you fight a big giant snake or something.
I can dig it. I can get behind this for sure. But man,
I'm just a bit surprised because you're kind of saying this like this only just occurred to you, but like I feel like this must have sort of crept up on you while you were researching it, like before the episode.
Yeah,
right?
Of course. I mean, I don't mean to say it like it's only just occurring to me. I guess part of me feels like I should, you know, I gotta give this its due respect. You've met the author here, and I really don't want to like yuck anybody's yum or poo-poo somebody's beliefs. And so when I see, you know, we have to bring offerings that will then be buried by the nearest tree or given to the nearest body of running water, like, I am not somebody who is into mysticism, really. Not really into, I don't really have any sort of outlandish mystical beliefs. I'm not even a religious person. And so I don't want to look at that and be like, eh, like for real, I gotta go, you know, throw my bag of weed in the stream. I don't want
to
like,
I mean, that's the joke, but I mean, I think it's fair to ask. We're just doing our role-playing game podcast.
Fair to ask, but I don't want to come off as being like disrespectful of this, because the fact is like, maybe this isn't really a game. Maybe this is something else. Something else entirely. Maybe it's not even really meant to be used as a game, but instead as like a therapeutic tool to overcome trauma. Because there is a lot of stuff in here that is talking about healing, you know, community power and healing. Talking about those things are almost like mantras more than talking about game mechanics. It does also feel weird to like include this alongside the likes of I don't know, Fatal or something. Other ridiculous RPGs that we've covered in the Danger Room. This feels a bit incongruous with the usual stuff I bring, where it's like, haha, you got you inherited a mastodon that you don't want.
I mean in the glossary and resources you've got like Nobilis and City of Mist is shouted out. But like I definitely get what you're saying, but like, I don't know. I don't, I don't feel like we're approaching this with disrespect either.
No,
like,
I don't feel that we are.
Like,
I
hey,
just
this,
game, make,
this is a cool yeah, game. I want to see what's going on.
I don't
on.
Feel that we're approaching it with disrespect. See, I just want to make sure I don't, you know, I don't want to disrespect it, even though I look at some of these things and go like, but what does that mean? Like, is this, I keep coming back to the question. It's like, is this a game that you play? It does have,
I think
it
so.
Does have like a beginning and an end point, and it does have a role-playing conceit. We do create characters that I think the City of Mist thing is most clearly personified in the characters, because they are, the characters are sort of these divided beings, right? Where they have upper soul, mid soul, and undersoul, these different facets of the characters. Soul, I mean, ultimately the soul, their very being. And that, and much like City of Mist, you know, having these ideas of sort of the mundane facet of the character and then the mystical or powerful, otherworldly spirit side of the character. Those, I do see the connections to City of Mist. But I don't know, man. Here, well, the only thing to do is to keep going through it. I think I'm going to talk about the center and then the souls, which are the characters. And that might be sort of what I cover on this one, because we still have to talk about like that, how the actions of the game function, the Oprimus or Oprimus. I got to look up how to pronounce that. Do you know how to pronounce that?
I said Oprimus. I don't know. It just rings off.
It's just because I'm familiar with, you know, the band Primus, and it's got Primus. The word Primus is right in there. Oprimus. But the Oprimus is sort of the antagonistic force of the game. And so I'll get into those next time. But let's talk a bit about the center. As I said, the point of reference that I found to Nobilis was the chancel. So after the offerings are placed in the gates, the group establishes the center, a communal space where they can all go, and a unique object that is the key that leads them to the center. This can be done through the talking method or the drawing method. So the quester describes one piece of the communal space through speaking or drawing it communally on a piece of paper. I like that the gate sort of accommodates different methods of conveying the information, like the talking method or the drawing method. Either one is just as valid. The key should also be decided upon in this manner. It must be an object that, when summoned into the spirit lands, will bring any quester back to the center. Examples of centers are forest glades, castles, space stations, subterranean cities, mountaintop bonfires, windswept beaches, submarines, and meeting chambers on floating sky islands. So, the base, right? That was also an aspect of City of Mist, was you got to have your base of operations. We have talked about, you know, having the base of operations in various Forged in the Dark games, like Wicked Ones or the Chancel in Nobilis. Examples of keys are crystal skulls, glowing rainbow spheres, talismans in the shape of a golden scarab, drums painted as star-filled skies, staffs engraved with the initials of every questor, wooden alicorn statues, seashells that play melodies, silver roses. So just some cool, unique item. The group must also choose tokens to represent their community power. We will definitely talk about power next time, because that's like a whole other section of this game. And then the souls. Once the community tokens are decided and the center and its key are created, the group can take a short break and then return to the gates, where the guide describes to them the secret of why they answered the call. Each quester reflects the essence of the cosmos. The cosmos has upper worlds, mid worlds, and underworlds. So too, each quester has an upper soul, a mid soul, and an undersoul. The mid soul is the body they are used to in their world. Now, this is what I find interesting. The body that is sitting with the other questers' bodies at the gates. So, Tom, when I, McGill, sit in the circle and play the gates, am I, McGill, the guy who's talking right now, the midsoul? The boundaries, yes, between the game and reality are very fuzzy with this one, it seems.
The midsole is the body they are used to in their world. The body that is, That's
so. You. I, McGill, am the midsole. I don't have the option of my midsole being someone else. The undersole is the part of the quester that is connected to or a reincarnation of one of their ancestors and has access to the collective power and knowledge of their ancestry. So this is why that interests me, is like, if I'm restricted to playing McGill, so my ancestry is like Scottish, English, Irish, and some Scandinavian.
This is one thing that is really fascinating to me. Yeah, absolutely. My idea was, I pitched this before on the show, is like, I want my ancestry soul to be like all the screw ups, all the people I'm related to that like didn't make it basically, or like, you know, succumb to addiction or some nonsense. Like, I like the idea of looking at my ancestry that way. And it's less about like, but it is very interesting, is like, are you restricted in your ancestry?
Yeah. Does it have to be my specific family ancestry, or can it be the...
Can you keep digging your way back until you get some Sumerian motherfucker?
So here's the thing, Tom. Here's a fun fact about me. My sister's a biologist, and years ago she sequenced her DNA, and we learned a lot about our family genetic makeup. And it turns out that my father's side of the family, our DNA has more Neanderthal DNA in it than about 80% of the population. We got a lot of Neanderthal.
Whoa, you're like primal.
Yeah, well, and the funny thing is, can you think of like a dominant physical trait about my appearance that might tip you off that I got a lot of Neanderthal DNA in me?
I mean, well, it's those hairy knuckles you're always dragging around, well, McGill. No, I don't know. Is it your jaw or forehead?
I got these big, black, bushy eyebrows, right? Like, really big, black, bushy eyebrows. And my dad has them, too. And all his side of the family has these big, big, bushy eyebrows. I can't help but think, like, there it is. You know? I do. I have a vaguely Neanderthal forehead. Yeah. But here's the...
Your brow.
My brow. Exactly. The foot family brow is a thing. Like, the women on my dad's side have it too. All the people on my dad's side of the family have these distinctive big bushy eyebrows. Could be the caveman in us. But all that to say, so I got all this Neanderthal DNA apparently. So maybe... Maybe my undersoul is like primal, is spear from primal. I'm a tough as nails Neanderthal man. The upper soul is the part of the
you wish.
ouch. Oh. The upper soul is the part of the quester.
I mean, you just said tough as nails Neanderthal man. I think if anything, it's like, yeah, maybe I'm a huge badass. It's like, shut up.
Well, I mean, yeah, that is true. But I also said I was a Neanderthal, so it's not all.
It's a self debt. You're trying to find the silver lining in the self deprecation.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, the upper soul is the part of the quester that is connected to the many past lives that they have lived, the cumulative lessons and power of those lives, be they animal, mineral, plant, human, or other beings not known on this world but exist in other worlds. This is very interesting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is the one where you can get really wild, because who knows? It's like, my suggestion for this one was like, oh, I'm going to go through all my past lives. Okay, I was a bat. A bug, a reptile, a bat, a bug.
Well, you know what this makes me think of is like the whole idea of the upper soul being connected to many past lives. It's kind of like a cloud atlas kind of a thing almost.
I don't know if I'm familiar enough with it to speak on that.
Oh, have you not
that.
Seen Cloud Atlas? You've seen the Rick and Morty episode making fun of it.
Yeah, and I've like seen bits of it, but well, yeah, I couldn't tell.
Whether or not you think it is a it succeeds or is a good movie, I leave that up to the listener. But the, one of the main conceits of the movie is that it takes place over many different eras of humanity. Like there is one story takes place in a cyberpunk future world. Another story takes place in the far-flung future that's like post-apocalyptic. And that's the one that they parody on Rick and Morty with Tom Hanks being like, you speak of the true. So, you know, tribal apocalypse, there's a cyberpunk one, but then there's also one about like an English explorer in the age of sail. There's one about a guy who is an apprentice to a pianist, and I think it's set in like the 40s, maybe the 30s. There's one, of course, set in modern times. So, but it's the same actors playing different characters in each of those eras, and the idea is that it's like telling the story of these souls being reincarnated in different lives, in different periods of history. Some of them in the far future and some of them sort of fantastic. So I get a very similar vibe here where it's like the upper soul is sort of like the Cloud Atlas facet, where it is the collected sort of power and knowledge of all the different people and beings that you have inhabited throughout the existence of the soul. Obviously, this is a game that really believes in reincarnation. So, when a quester goes through the gates into the spirit lands, they can take the form of either their upper soul or their undersoul. Each of those souls has power sources unique to them and a domain that is the essence of both. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess the fact that I would be playing just myself, I guess that only affects the undersoul. And the upper soul is where I can get really creative and decide on the past forms that my soul has taken. You may know exactly what your upper soul and undersoul look like, or you may have no clue at all. Your upper soul and undersoul become clearer and more detailed the closer you come to remembering your true self and who you really are. If you're struggling to describe your upper soul to the other questers, you can start by understanding that soul as a humanoid-shaped body of light, either pure starlight or your favorite color. If you're struggling to describe your undersoul, especially if you have little to no understanding of your own ancestry, you can start by understanding that soul as a humanoid-shaped shadow. The description of your souls can transform when necessary. All that is needed is for you to update the group whenever your souls shift or become clearer. Once you have described the forms of your souls, you can go on to describe your power sources and your domain. Sometimes the souls become more clear once the sources and domains are established. We'll be covered more when we talk about powers. A domain should be your personal space beyond the gates within the spirit lands that you can retreat to recharge your power sources and heal. So I guess like a sanctum. It should evoke the essence of both your upper soul and undersoul. It should have representations of each of your power sources. It should feel like your ideal home or room, like the examples of the centers. Domains can also look like forest glades, castles, space stations, subterranean cities, etc. They should have a corresponding domain key. So we're dealing with like, you know, you create the center and that's the communal space for all the players. And then you have your specific domain, which is like your character's sanctum, or I guess your sanctum. It's very much rooted in like who you the player are. You can describe as much or as little of your domain to the other questers, but it is important to describe its key so that if they need to pull you out of battle for some reason and for some reason cannot get you to the center key, they can then summon your domain key to take you to safety. I think that's pretty cool. There's still a lot to talk about here, but we've now got like the conceit of the game, how it starts out, and the stuff needed to create a character. The three facets of your character, right? There is you, the player, and then there is the sort of shadow soul, the undersoul that represents your own past, and then there is the soul of light that is where you can get creative and sort of elaborate upon it based on the interesting things that you want your soul to have done prior to inhabiting you, I guess. this is really interesting stuff. Like I do feel like I'd love to just know the ultimate motivation of this. Like, what is the thesis of this? Is this designed to be used as like a therapeutic tool, or is this something that you'd rather play for fun? It feels like it takes itself very seriously, and that's fine. But in turn, that makes me go like, okay, but like what, when I sit in the circle in a game of the gates, when I sit down with the other players, what mood?
It takes itself seriously, and that like makes you want to engage with it seriously.
Yes,
right?
Yes, but like, what mood should I be in, right? Should I be, you know, when I sit down with other players for a game of D&D, I usually have a lot of energy in me. I'm like, oh man, you know, what crazy encounters are we going to have this time? What monsters are we going to face? What scrapes are we going to get into? When I sit down in the circle for a game of the gates, quote unquote, like, should I be in a place of serenity when I sit down? Am I supposed to walk away from this feeling enlightened, or is the idea that I want to be walking away from a game of the gates feeling energized and going like, oh man, wasn't that amazing, wasn't that interesting when we did that thing? Because that's usually what I feel when I'm getting into or coming away from any given RPG, is that I got like a bit of excitement where I'm like, oh, can you believe that happened? But I don't know if that's the goal here.
Well, I mean, we've been going on it for a while now, and I kind of want to get back to my situation.
Let's do it.
Well, are we going to answer this question about the gates, or just explore it next time?
We will explore it next time. There's still more to cover, and maybe the more we talk about it, the more we will sort of zero in on how the gates is meant to be played, or maybe just how you and I would go about doing it.
Also, I don't know, could maybe see if Lucaya wants to be on the podcast.
I'd certainly be open to that.
So, the statue is crumbling to the point where only a small core shard seems to be glowing, the rest breaking off like stale bread. The female giant shrieks at the elephant and the devastation it has wrought. They appear to be living their own nightmarish bull in a china shop scenario. The one further away comes rushing over with his hands open before him in shocked horror, before roaring his displeasure and hurling a piece of the dilapidated factory at the elephant. The elephant makes a strength saving throw. Giant says, poor Dumbo. The elephant cries out as the rock strikes its side like a cannonball. Meanwhile, the female giant has picked up a massive scimitar, which she brings down on the elephant. With two devastating strikes, the female giant decapitates the elephant. Mere seconds from its summoning, it returns to its form as a marble figurine. It is Gent's turn. You can see that just a sliver of the remains of the statue is still glowing. And, she says, oh, I don't really have any smashing utensils. And I say, the remains of the crystal seem fragile enough that any physical damage might cause it to shatter. I say, okay, I will take out my sunblade and attack some slivers, 15 to hit. And I say, I should say, you're about 45 feet from the crystal. And they're like, sorry, no map. It's been a while. I say, okay, instead I will shoot. They shoot the crystal with a gun. They take out their Hermes compact and blast it.
That's their solution to everything.
The bullet embeds in the shard of crystal, cracks vein their way through the sliver until it finally shatters. The glow dissipates, and the giants seem to shake themselves clear of its influence. Gent says, you're welcome. As the crystal cracks and crumbles, you detect a faint violet glow disappearing from deep within. Immediately after, the stone giants stop attacking and come out of their immediate madness, reeling in horror as they see the damage they have wrought to the factory. What have we done? What have we done? They cry, suddenly overcome with the realization of their madness. Treacherous slavers! The female giant growls, though she does not direct her words at the group. Connor pipes up. Yeah, we were hoping you'd help us with them. We have an army, you see. And Gent says, nothing says revenge like vengeance. And Hex says, he'll continue. We've come to end the reign of the human supremacists. We're convening to attack Ash Green Outpost and then the mantle itself. Will you join us? They came not long ago, we think. The giant speaks as if trying to parse their own thoughts. The humans that we had traded with in the past, they brought the crystal. The giant points to the ruined statue. We were quickly drawn to it. Its beauty blinded us. We hastily agreed to new arrangements just to secure it. The humans demanded that the majority of us go with them to mine for more of the crystal. Most did so without hesitation. It seemed, at the time, more a promise of payment than toil. The giant frowns deeply. Gent says, do you know where they were going to mine more of this stuff? The giant answers Hex first. Yes, we must rescue our kin from the oppression that we have worked for so long to avoid. Some of them may be slow to trust you, even as you seek to liberate them. For these, we can supply an incentive. The other giant walks to the back of the factory, then returns shortly with a chest that it carries in one hand. It lays it down before the group, opening it, and they see that the chest is full of gold, and they each get plus 200 gold each. Then to Gent's question, they reply, it comes from the Underdark. They must dig deep to harvest such materials. Gent's new gold total is brought up to 19,129 gold. Hex asks, is there something you could give us to help us convince your friends that we are here to help them? An insignia or a phrase? And the giant says, I am certain that the tyranny they now face will make an offer of dignified liberty an alluring prospect. Simply make it known that they will be paid if they fear moving from one slaver to another. Not all should be so stubborn. Moreover, we shall assist you. Simply tell us where to join your army, the giant says. Connor pulls out his map and brochure to show the giant. Both giants grab their scimitars and prepare to set out. They gaze upon their factory with sadness, knowing they will have much to do upon their return. And then I ask, what now? You still haven't reached the location that Issa showed you in your minds. The waterfall and the river, etc. And Hex also says, by the way, we met a resourceful goblin who had worked here, who had managed to break the curse and seek help. Deg was his name. And I said, I don't think Deg ever claimed to work at the factory. He just hid out inside of it. And they're like, oh, my bad. The stone giant thinks on this but shrugs. I know not of such a goblin. The other reminds them, the one that came to see the statue. You were quite hard on him. And Hex says, yep, and he's the reason we're here. So, you know, maybe make him a nice chair or something. Both giants frown, remembering who they were while under the influence of the madness. They nod. He will be welcome here, should he return. Perhaps we shall find him when this is over and done with. Hex says, all right, let's get back to finding this river and waterfall area. Hey, you giants don't happen to know where that is, do you? And while they are chatting, Gent goes and gathers some of the crystal shards. The giants give simple directions to the nearest river. They admit that they don't venture beyond the factory often. Gent gets some Underdark crystal shards. Then they head out again. And Hex says, yeah, we can at least follow the river to try and find these guys. And I think that's where I'm going to break.
All right.
They've just added the stone giants, and we'll continue with them heading for that river.
Well, and a key thing that I noticed here is now I get the Sith Morcane connection. Wasn't really getting it before then, but now I understand.
Which is that? What do you mean?
You're saying materials come from the Underdark, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Is Sith Morcane not a drow outpost in the Underdark?
Yeah, but really in my version of this module, Sith Morcane is replaced with Ash Brain Outpost.
Well, never mind. Forget I said that.
There's a point somewhere coming up where, like, I'm trying to show them, like, what Ash Grain Outpost would look like. And I just say, like, I just type, like, man, I just got kind of entranced by, like, some pretty grim pictures on Google image search of, like, industrial mining gone out of control. Yeah. So I think that's it for us for this episode,
it
eh?
It sure is. More gates next
time.
So
if you... Yeah, we'll do more of all this next time. So if you want to get in touch with us, simply we post on Facebook, Comparing Campaign on Facebook. You can message us, you can follow us, all that good stuff. And if you want to see our supplemental materials and show notes, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. But we're having some trouble with that, some technical difficulties on my end. So we'll see how that gets going. Who knows if the gate's is a game or not? Not me. I think it's a game.
Well, it doesn't seem like you level up. But you can certainly get that offering and then
you get those tokens.
Get that deck of tarot cards and then throw your bottle of beer into the river.
Not me. Take care, everybody.